lovely Jen from Rush Hair is sitting in front of me. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning, Lee.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
And how's business, more importantly, I suppose?
Busy, actually. We're quite known now. Everyone's coming, which is good.
Good, because, yeah, when did you... Was it November?
Yeah, 28th of November.
Right, so how long does it take to establish something like a hairdresser's?
Usually quite a while. I mean, I think it helped that we had offers, so we kind of sped things up, and it didn't take long for people to know, and word of mouth was excellent.
I know, I must say, when I've walked past your salon a couple of times, you are always very busy.
Yeah, we always have people in, always, which is... thankfully, good.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, you're here now to talk about the new styles that are in fashion at the moment. Where did these styles come from? Who decides what's in fashion?
Celebrities.
Is it?
Famous people, yeah. I think catwalk and, you know, like the shows, the fashion shows, they have an impact on the celebrities, and then the celebrities have an impact on the rest of us. So it all comes from magazines and runway shows. The whole lot.
That seems a bit unfair on us because the celebrities are normally very beautiful.
Yeah, skinny, tall, and, you know, have loads of hair.
I know, loads of hair and loads, you know, people to do their hair every second
all
of the
time. Yeah.
So how practical are these styles that are in fact? We'll talk about what they are in just a moment, but how practical are they for just, you know, your average person?
We change them, so we tweak. We have, like, a focal point, and then we work with that. We work with the hair that's sitting in our chair. We don't just copy from a magazine straight on someone's head. We kind of change it and tweak it a little bit.
Yes, I was going to say, you know, I've gone into a hairdresser with a style saying, I want to look like that.
Yes.
And the hair has been cut exactly as in the picture, but it hasn't transformed me into Demi Moore, surprisingly.
Yeah, no, yeah. I do say sometimes, you know, we'll try and get a plastic surgeon in and we'll see what we can do. But yeah, it doesn't always work like that.
It's a whole makeover.
Yeah.
So what is in fashion at the moment? What hairstyles will we be seeing more of?
I've seen a lot of short hairstyles now. A lot of people are coming in with long hair saying, you know, I've seen so-and-so and she's got collarbone length hair and I want it that length. So a lot of short choppy styles, and the mini fringes are back.
Mini fringe? What's a mini fringe?
Like the very choppy and quite high up. So quite away from the eyebrow.
Now, do you have to be a certain age to carry something like that off?
No, I've
honestly,
seen...
Honestly, though, Jen, honestly.
Honestly, no. So, it depends if you've got... So, like, a younger person could have, like, collarbone-length hair and have a micro fringe, which is really short and very, like, sharp. And then you could have someone who's a little bit older, who's got short hair, very textured, and you can have a micro fringe, but... more textured and not so blunt on the forehead. So it can, again, be tweaked to different styles, really.
I'm pleased to hear that these are short styles because I've got short hair. Yeah. And, you know, once you have short hair, you always think, oh, there's not an awful lot I can do with it.
Yeah.
But you are saying within that, there's all sorts of options.
No, there is, yeah. There's a lot to do with it. Texture, sleek. You can have it really sleek one day and then really textured. And products as well play a big thing into the texture.
And are these styles easy to maintain? Because most of us have busy lives. We haven't got, you know, half an hour to spend each morning with straighteners, etc.
I mean, they are shorter haircuts, I find, are easier to maintain because you can just, like, finger dry it. You don't have to do too much with them. And also, the only thing that I would say is maintainable is that you have to have it trimmed because they grow faster. Because they're at that length, and an inch is pretty big difference when you have short hair.
I was watching The Night Manager last night. Don't you have been watching the John le Carré thing on BBC One? There's an actress in there and she's very tall, very beautiful, and she's got very short hair she looks fabulous. But I do wonder, you know, does that sort of style suit everyone? Because she's got a beautifully shaped head and she's very pretty.
Yeah.
Because it really does draw attention to all of those things, doesn't it?
Because everything is out. Once you've got short hair, there's no... You know, like some people say, I want it below the chin because I don't want to see the chin, or just framing. So once your hair's short, everything is on show. But I think there's ways of working short haircuts for everyone.
So when someone comes in to you and says, you know, maybe they've got long hair and they want it short, you look at their face shape and everything about them, their height and their neck
length. Everything into consideration, their, you know, their age, the way they dress also plays a big part, and just their everyday life, kind of lifestyle that they have. So if someone who works in the city, for example, in an office, wants to come in and have really choppy, textured hair, it's fine, but I then need to teach her how to wear it at work as well. So you can wear everything anywhere, just know how to style it almost.
Because it's a bit of a gamble, isn't it, if you go from long hair to short? It's, you know, you have to wait. If you don't like it, you have to wait for it to grow back again.
Yeah.
Do you make it clear?
Are you sure?
Yes, because once those scissors go in, there's no going back.
But people love it. It's a big change, but they do like it. They love it.
Well, I'm glad to shortcuts are in, because what you're describing as well, it's short and feminine. It doesn't have to be boyish, does it?
No, so nothing too sharp, like the hairlines or anything like that. Still very soft, but short. Just, I think it works on women as well.
Excellent. And colour as well. Are there certain colours that are in this season?
I definitely think that people are going more for like multi-tonal colours. So something like a product that we have is Anoa. It's ammonia free and it's very natural. It still covers, for example, white hair, but what it does with that is it doesn't make every strand in the head. It's not going to be one colour. It's got multi-tonal going through it. It's a bit light in some areas, but still covers.
Is that what multi-tonal means? It means if you look at it, it's not just one bank of colour.
It's not a block colour. It's more of a natural, kind of a seamless effect. Still very natural.
And is that, because it's permanent and semi-permanent, isn't it? I know it seems obvious, but can you just describe the difference?
Yeah, so a permanent colour is something that grows out. Permanent, still, they do fade, so you have to maintain them. Still have your hair coloured, I'd say about 6 to 8 weeks. And then a semi-permanent, there's two types. There's a quasi and a semi. A semi is a true semi, which washes out after about 10 washes. And then a quasi is something that lasts a little bit longer and it fades out of the hair, doesn't grow out of the hair.
And people are sometimes worried about colouring their hair because you mentioned an ammonia-free product then, but obviously people associate colour with a lot of chemicals. Is that still the case?
It is the case in the sense that bleach is bleach, you know? It's got to be harsh to be able to get the results that we want. So if hair is very dark and we want to go really light, it is a process. And if you're using all the right products and having all the right treatments, then no, it's not going to damage your hair because you're doing everything right. I think people forget the bits like the treatments or the regular trims. People just go straight in and they're like, right, I want to go blonde. Don't want to have a treatment, but I just want to go blonde. That is damaging. But if you think, you know, if you come in, have a treatment, then you can go blonde and it's not damaging. I don't think it is.
And are there certain rules for colouring? It was 20 years ago. Somebody said, you know, you never go darker, you always go lighter. Is that, I don't know whether that's true or not. No, you can do anything you want now, can you?
You can do anything you want. We've got all the products out there to help the hair stay healthy, help it grow, help, you know, just maintain the health of the hair. So there's a lot of products out there that can help with that, and anything is possible.
And presumably, as you do with a cut, you would look at a person's face shape and their eye colour and all of those kinds of things.
With colour as well, yeah, definitely. You can't, you know, there are certain rules with colour, like how dark you might bring someone or how light, but again, I truly believe that it depends on how you wear it. To your hair, and you could be really light skinned and have really pale skin and still have dark hair if you wear it the right way. And it's the cut and the colour play big parts with each other. So if they're done right, it will work.
And I like this hair dipping thing that's going on at the moment.
The dip dyes.
Yes, the dip dyes. That's if people don't know what the dip dyes is, it's just the end of the hair, isn't it?
And there's so many types of dip dyes. There's like an ombre, there's a balayage, and then there is that. It's almost like hair's been dipped into a bowl of colour, and they're still very much in, and they've been around for about 2 years now and they're still going strong.
Yeah, and actually see a lot of younger women, you know, teenagers wearing that. That doesn't damage the hair. It's the same effect as an ordinary colour.
Sometimes it's just a shade lighter, so it's not that we're bringing it up really light. It's just giving it that natural lightness to it. It's really nice, actually. I like dip dyes.
So we talked about the new cuts, the new colours. How long do these sort of stay in vogue? You know, when would you sort of notice a change in maybe the styles or colours?
I think definitely with colour, seasonal. So like in the winter and the autumn, people like to go a bit richer, a bit deeper. And then as the sun comes out, people are like, oh, and a bit of lightness in there. So people start to go a bit lighter or maybe a bit warmer. So definitely seasonal.
Well, yeah, lovely to talk to you, Jen. And between our last two talks, I've been to look around your salon. It is lovely. You must be very proud.
Yeah, I am proud, actually, yeah, of what we've accomplished together.
yeah, it just seems a nice team. Everybody seemed very happy there.
Yeah.
And you do spoil people when they come, don't you? It's a full tea and biscuits routine, you know.
Yeah, it's an actual teapot.
it's
nice.
But women, it is a treat for women to go and have their haircut. They do like all that.
Yeah.
Because lots of women just don't get it's the only time they get to sit still, really, the only excuse.
So true, and it amazes me still to see how excited people get when they see like the Lindor chocolate or the biscuits. They're like, "Oh, chocolate!"
Oh,
like,
Lindor chocolate. Yeah, I didn't know that was there.
Oh yes, we do. Biscuits and Lindor chocolates go well.
Well, I'm pleased to see it's going so well for you. Apart from this delivery van, if it's listening, who keeps knocking down your sign.
Yes, stop, please.
Yes, that's why you couldn't come in last time. It's your sign that sticks out that keeps being knocked down by a delivery van.
It's very sad.
Very sad. Well, we'll be talking to you again, hopefully, in about 4 or 5 weeks. Yeah. But until then, thank you ever so much.
Thank you for having me, Jen.
Oh, you're very welcome. Always lovely to talk to you.
Cambridge Go Club celebrates its 50th anniversary. And Cambridge Go player Andrew Symonds has won the UK Championship. We've managed to get hold of him at very short notice. So the Tithe Barn interview that we were going to replay this morning, we'll replay later this week on 105 Today. So you can hear that interview coming up later in the week. Now, there's an event taking place, which is being run by the Cambridge Go Club. It's on Saturday. Everyone's going to be welcome to come and try out the game. And I have never heard of Go. Andrew Symonds is in the studio with me this morning, and he's going to explain exactly what Go is all about. You've only got 15 minutes to do it, Andrew.
Okay.
Good morning. So where do we start?
Well, Go is a two-player game. It's a board game. It's originated in China probably more than 2,500 years ago. The rules are quite simple to get started, but it's quite a deep and complex game to really sort of master and get into it. So it starts off with a board which is empty, with 19 by 19 lines.
So not like your 64 squares for your checkers game, or if you're playing chess, of course.
The normal board is 19 by 19, which is quite big. But you can also, for beginners, you can play on smaller boards, such as a 9 by 9, which makes it easier to learn and get started with. So at this event that we're having, the tournament on Saturday, we'll have the Trigantius tournament for players who already know how to play. That will be on the 19 by 19 full-size board. But there's also going to be a novices event where we'll be teaching beginners the rules, and for that we'll be using the smaller boards.
So it's a bit actually then, Andrew, like learning five a side in football. We're on a smaller pitch, everything's miniaturised until you get sort of sophisticated in the game. You can have fun on five a side, and then you sort of get up to the full 19 by 19 board.
Yeah, exactly.
So presumably with 19 by 19 there's a sort of a whole complex perplexity of different moves. And you're always thinking ahead. Is it a bit like chess?
Yes.
Where you've got to get a strategy together and you're already three or four moves ahead, wherever you can be?
Yeah, so it's there's a combination of sort of big board thinking and strategy, and then tactics and calculating the variations, planning ahead. But as well as that, it's quite a visual game. So you have an idea of, kind of as you play and develop and get more experience, you have an idea of moves which look nice, a nice shape, and so it's quite a creative and intuitive game as well. Often you can't really describe why you think a move is right, it just feels good to you.
Just that intuitiveness, something little extra sense that says that's what you should do. So it's a flat board, so it's played in two dimensions.
Yep.
I guess as most traditional games are. It goes back a long way, over 2,000 years.
Mm. So yes, it originated in China. Confucius wrote about it. There's various legends about where it started. It's been played in the UK. Well, so the Cambridge Go Club is one of the oldest ones, about 50 years. And it's more popular in Asia, but it's growing in popularity in Europe and America, places like that.
And so would I face you if I was your opponent? Is it as in a game of chess? And I'm sorry to keep harping back to game of chess, but I'm sort of trying to get the concept in my head. So we face each other across a table with this board on in front of us.
Yeah, so the way the game works is it's one player versus one player. You each take turns to place pieces on the board. One person's black, one person is white. And once you place you place them on the lines of the board, on the intersections, and once you've placed them, they don't move, so it's different to chess in that way. And you gradually start with the empty board and you fill it up, and the aim of the game is to surround more territory than your opponent. So basically you start with this sort of empty land and you're trying to divide it up amongst the two players, and you're trying to get more than your opponent. And you do that by trying to surround the territory, and you can also surround your opponent and capture them. So if you've got the grid, which has got these lines, if you imagine you have one piece, it's got four spaces around it on the lines, if you could imagine a square grid. And if one piece, if you had a black piece and then white surrounded it on the four places around it, that black piece would be captured and taken off the board. So that's the sort of the basic game mechanic.
And a capture is a win?
So a capture, so you get 1 point for a capture, and you also get 1 point for each space you surround of your territory. So your score, the end of the game, your score is the surrounded points plus your captures, and whoever has the most wins.
Okay. And are you under a clock like you would in a professional game of chess?
So yes, in tournaments we use clocks, but when we play in a club or something, a friendly game, you just play without a clock. So I mean, a game might last an hour maybe. Some can be longer. So for the British Championship, they're quite serious games. So each player there has 3 hours of time, which is pretty long for a Go game.
And the game must be up to a certain point score. So at 3 hours, then, Andrew, you would say that's it? Time at end of bout, end of competition?
We have a little bit of overtime. So at the end, we play with like 1 minute per move. So you have to be a bit faster, but it means you can at least finish the game.
And you would get to an ultimate conclusion, and there would be a winner.
Yes.
Always. So past the 3 hours.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So this coming weekend, Saturday, you kind of open your doors to the game of Go to people in Cambridge. You're organising an event for the Cambridge University Social Club, and you'll be inviting people to learn the rules at 10:45 on the smaller board.
Yeah.
So bring juniors along. Mums and dads, bring their boys and girls with them. Would you say that a good attribute is to be able to say that they can play chess? Again, sort of trying to give some comparative.
Yeah, it probably would sort of help. But, I mean, you don't need to play chess, but it probably if you do play chess and you've got some sort of those, skills for board games and sort of planning ahead and that kind of thing, then that could help, but you don't need to.
Andrew, you're the UK champion at this for this year. Presumably the title is contested every year.
That's correct, yes. Yeah.
But you, to get yourself into the final, you did the semi-finals, I guess, the quarter-finals. Mm. You did it at home, from home. How does that work?
Well, so the title match was a best of three. And so the first game we had at a Cambridge Go Players house. The second game was my house here in Cambridge. And then the third and deciding game was at the other player, at his mum's house.
And you go to you don't play remotely online or something. You're not playing an electronic version. You're playing with the physical pieces on the board?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can play online, and I do play online and many people do, but for serious tournaments, you play on the board,
There must be strict rules, I'm sure. Mm. So is there an adjudicator, a judge? Is there somebody who's overseeing? You'd never cheat, of course.
Oh.
But is there somebody with you to tot up the scores? An official, shall we say?
Yeah, so there was a referee and broadcaster. So for the championship match, it was broadcast online for other interested Go players to watch and comment as the game was in progress.
Televised from your front parlour or front room, something like that. And then you go to... I was thinking, this must be a sort of shiny event, almost in a ring, spotlighted, all under pressure, sweat from your brow. It must be in London Hilton or another posh hotel. But it's subtle. the way you do it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
International competition. So, I mean, as you are now the UK champion, do you go forward to a European competition or something more international?
So there is what's called the World Amateur Go Championship, which happens every year, and that's in Japan or China. And so each country with a Go organisation can send a player. So I will be going as the British representative to that in... the date's not fixed yet. It will be sort of May or June this year in China.
Who would fund that for you, Andrew?
So the organisers pay for the hotel, but I have to pay for the flight there.
Do you feel that the game generally, internationally as well as nationally, is gaining more momentum now? Do you feel that it's getting a bit more publicity, more awareness?
It's definitely, it's growing around the world and,
Do you think probably the fact that it's now man is going to take on computer? Remember years ago, probably you were very small, if not even born at the time. Deep Blue was the program which was developed in the USA. And of course, Garry Kasparov, the Russian champion, world champion, took on Deep Blue. I think the first time round, he beat
the
program.
That's right. Yeah.
The second time round, it cracked him, so to speak.
Yes.
Do you think... that we've got to the point. Fan Hui is going to be playing on Saturday in the Far East in Korea. Mm-hmm. He's the world's top most rated professional. By the way, do you think you'll go professional?
Oh, no. No, I mean, in the professionals in Asia start training as sort of 5-year-old kids, 8 hours a day. It's in the UK. I'm, a top player. I went on a sort of a Go holiday to Korea, and it was quite humbling that there was just hundreds of 10-year-olds who can easily beat me.
And did they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Oh, Andrew.
Little children.
Lots of modesty. Yeah. So Lee Sedol is going to take on the big server with the big program. The program is I've lost it here. I've got the details. It's called AlphaGo.
Mm-hmm.
So that means if it's only in an alpha form, what happens when it becomes a beta version? It's going to rule the world or something like that. But it's the first real challenge against a human professional player. And pitched in is a £1 million bounty. So if the human, the world genius that is Lee Sedol, can beat the machine, $1 million. What do you reckon his odds are?
So they played their first game this morning. And before that...
Was that just a warm-up or was that an official...
No, that was the official first... So they've got 5 games. They played the first one this morning. It was starting at 4 a.m. UK time. I got up to watch it.
You did? Good. Yeah.
And Lee Sedol lost. So the computer won.
By a what sort of margin?
Well, so it was... It was won by resignation. But on the board, it was a few points... But for a professional, a few points is quite a big margin.
So if you think you get to a point as a contender where there's no way out, it's like, again, in chess, you find checkmate is just around the corner.
Mm.
You can say...
Yeah, yes, you can resign instead of going to the very end.
Yeah, to go to the very end, which is what Lee Sedol did.
Mm.
Ooh, 4 more to go. Tense, biting, nails, and he left. We'll have to see. So just a little bit more news about what will be happening this Saturday. You're going to be teaching the rules to new players on the smaller board, as well as watching some, shall we say, of those of more accomplished nature, such as yourself playing on the 19 by 19 grid. You're also going to have a novices go competition with prizes for junior players. You're going to be doing that in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. So... how many more people can go along? We hopefully plenty of people can go along. Can I give out a few details as well for the person who's organising this? It's Paul Smith. We can give out his email address. He put it in the press release. So I gave this out a little bit earlier on. We'll give it out again. paul361smith@gmail.com. You can email Paul Smith if you want to find out more about Saturday. The entry, if you want to go along to this, is free. You can text Paul as well. It's 07503 898 934. That number again is 07503 898 934, and they'll be happy to answer your questions and provide more information. Cambridge Runner 5 wants to send a reporter down on Saturday as well, so we'll have a report from the scene, which will run next week, probably on the 105 Today program, so you can catch that next week. And you can also meet Andrew Simons, who's very unassuming, I have to say, in the studio with me today. I rather sort of honour him, put him on a special pedestal, pinnacle somewhere for being the UK champion at this. I almost feel like I've met Garry Kasparov this morning. That's very humbling, I know. You've got a day job. Mm-hmm. And you've been let off early. And your background is in the analytical world, isn't it, as well, Andrew? You went to University of Cambridge and studied?
Studied physics.
There you go, you see.
Yeah.
You've got a brain that can crunch all these numbers. Mm. Would you say it is an arithmetic game as well as one of strategy?
It's not arithmetic, but it's probably, if you're good at sort of analytical thinking, it will help you to play. But it's a nice mixture of sort of left and right brain, of analytical and creativity as well.
And Go organisers in Cambridge are always on the lookout for new players. Cambridge Go Club meets three times a week, and children can learn to play Go at the Cambridge Junior Chess and Go Club. Where do they meet then, Andrew?
So we have several clubs. We have the University Club, which meets on Wednesdays in Robinson College, but that's only during term time. So that's term's finishing just now. We've got the City Club, which used to meet in CB1 on Mill Road, but we now meet in the Devonshire Arms.
Down at the pub, all very civilised.
Yeah, at Sunday evenings. And the Junior Club is Wednesdays, but I can't remember. it's maybe at Milton School, or the Richmond Street, St. Augustus Church on Richmond Street.
There is the St. Augustus Church Hall on Richmond Street.
Yeah.
That'll be the one for the juniors. So they can go along after school, presumably. Yeah. Extracurricular evening.
Yeah, so if you want some details on that, contact Paul Smith. He runs that junior club.
Just a fascinating little, almost chink of light as I open the door to the game of Go. But Andrew, thank you very much for coming in to explain it to us.
You're welcome.
Have a wonderful big event on Saturday. And I'm gunning for the human being to win against the machine, because it's kind of a bit of a frightening aspect when you think computers can do everything now. Beat us at chess and beat us at Go.
Yeah.
You never know. You might take on a computer. Have you taken on a computer program yourself?
I have, yes. When I started playing, computers were not very good at all at Go. And a sort of average club player could beat them. But now, even before this AlphaGo announcement, the top computers are a bit better than me. And now with this AlphaGo, it's far, far, far better.
We can blame Google if the computer wins on Saturday.
We can.
Everyone wants to blame Google for everything. Andrew, thank you so much for coming in at short notice and talking to us today. Have a great day on Saturday. Mm. And I know which side you'll be gunning for as well in the international pit of wits between man and machine. And that was Andrew Simon there, who's the UK champion at the Game of Go, current champion.
Nigel Thomas, a very lovely Nigel Thomas, who's just bringing out his new album, Travelling Man, and the single Ghost Hunter. Hello, Nigel, how are you?
Hello, Susie, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Good, very good, thank you. I know, you must tell us all about your album and your career, actually, if that's not too much of a big question. But basically, you're on your own now. This is it. Big move.
Yes. Well, I started out in a band called The Foxes, and we did a lot of touring, released some singles and an album, and that was great. But then people started heading off and having babies and getting married and all that sort of thing. But
usual thing.
Stay doing music, so I've got Travelling Man out on Monday.
And you're a singer-songwriter, aren't you? Is that right, Nigel? So you wrote the song as well, did you?
Yes, yeah, it's all my own stuff, yeah.
Yes, and I hear here you've got one of your fans is the Blur, David Rowntree, and the indie mogul Alan McGee. Have you spoken to them and seen them or had worked with them at all? Or they're obviously very good fans of yours, aren't they?
Well, I used to DJ and promote down at Death Disco in Nottingham Arts Club for quite a few years. And that used to be run by Alan McGee and his friend Danny Watson. And then for a while we had Dave Rowntree down there DJing as well.
Right.
His DJ moniker was Dark Destroyer. Kind of got to know them all through that, really.
So, Nigel, what were your main musical influences that gave you some sort of eagerness to go into the music business? Were you always musically orientated? Had you done this from the beginning, or was it just came into it late? Or
no, pretty much from the start, really. My dad was a singer-songwriter as well, so when my mother was pregnant with me, I think he used to play guitar to to my mum's bump. So that was the, you know, I had a very early, I heard music very early. So yeah. I think that probably started the things off. And then I've always been a singer, but it was only when I moved to London, really, that I decided to do it professionally.
And talking about professional, you also write for London musicals, is that right?
I sort of co-wrote a musical in Colchester recently called Auditions, but I have been in a few musicals in London. It's mainly sort of through my love of acting and music as well, so it kind of combines together to do those kind of things. But I'm putting that on the back burner at the moment and really focusing on the music.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
I'm really, really pleased with the album and can't wait to unleash it to everyone.
And tours, what are the tours coming up, Nigel? What tours have you got coming up soon?
Well, the album launch party is on this Saturday at the Camden Barfly in London. But then on the Sunday, I'm playing at the Portland Arms in Cambridge as part of the Sunday Sessions show for Cambridge TV. Which I did once before last year, and it's a fantastic night. So hugely looking forward to that.
No, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. And that's why you're talking on the phone today as opposed to coming in, because you're in Somerset at the moment. Is that right?
I'm down in Somerset at the moment, yes.
Are you having time out?
Yes, a few days off, which is nice, which is rare, but nice. Yeah. I find it very hard to sit still and take time off. So
are you very excited about the album Travelling Man? You've got how many songs, how many tracks are on the Travelling Man?
There are 10 tracks on it.
Yeah.
It was recorded at Tyler House Studios, which is owned by Luke Oldfield, who's Mike's son. It was recorded, it's analog, so it's partly recorded on sort of old-fashioned tape. So I think that comes across in the sort of warmer sound that a lot of the tracks have.
All right.
I just put up a new music video made by my brother, Terry Thomas, which is a entirely handmade stop-motion animation video that took sort of thousands of hours to put together, and it's really quite impressive, I think.
My daughter is a computer animation, and I know from her experience that it takes a long time, doesn't it, to get all this put together? And so well done for you.
I don't know how people do that, have the patience to do that. I don't think I could do that.
So
impressive to see that kind of thing.
Well, all I've heard about that business is the people that work in animation are really, really nice people. That's what I keep hearing. So your brother must be a very, very nice man. That's all I can say. And obviously doing a lot of work for you as well. So, Nigel, I think we'll play your Travelling Man, if that's all right, and then we'll come back and talk a bit more about the album and where it's all going, if that's all right with you.
Please do. Sounds good.
Okay. I hit your lift from the harbour car park. Oh, there you go, Travelling Man by Nigel Thomas. And the lovely man is here today talking to me on the phone from Somerset. Nigel, that was beautiful. I was telling you earlier that my daughters love that song, and it is very, very lovely indeed. Just tell me, do you have to be determined to get into the music business? Because you were obviously, you had a job before you came into acting and singing, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I worked for the NHS for quite a few years.
That's really commendable.
I think you do have to take the sort of leap if you really want to do it, and it is a lot of hard work. But
you just have to be determined.
If you're passionate about something, then I think you have to go for it. And I think success doesn't always have to be judged in sort of fame and money. I think if you do something you love and that you create, and to be creative is a sort of gift in itself, and anything else is a bonus, a much welcome bonus, but still a bonus, I'd say.
You're absolutely right. Very wise words. And you really have to concentrate on what you enjoy first before thinking, actually, I want to be famous. You've got to really, really get to know your art, really, I suppose, haven't you?
I think so. And that's one of the reasons I'm so sort of against these sort of reality TV shows and these things where it's not about music. It's about sort of, almost laughing at people's dreams and hopes and that instant fame where... Whereas I think, you really have to sort of work for your art and, to really be successful,
I agree.
And truly an artist.
No, what, absolutely right. Completely.
We're getting very deep here, sorry.
No, it's fine. Oh, I can go deep, I tell you, but I really can. But let's just concentrate. Now, you told me that your album that's coming out on Monday is also on another version. Tell us about why you've released it on vinyl.
It is. I've released it on a heavyweight vinyl as well, and it's a also very old-fashioned format. But I do think there's a vinyl resurgence. I sort of noticed where I live in London, a vinyl shop's actually opened in the past few weeks. And while it's not a sort of it's not a big seller in the way that it obviously used to be in the 70s, I think there is a definite noticeable difference in the sound quality, and the warmth of having a vinyl record that you don't get from a slightly tinny MP3. I know it sounds slightly geeky, but I think it's true. And also, I think there's something that you miss in music from having a physical copy of something, being able to look at the cover, which is part of the experience, and hold the cover, and that whole sort of ritual of putting on a record, or even a CD to some extent, which I think you do miss with just pressing a button and suddenly you just have the music there.
And so, do you think the sales of the they call them gramophones now? What do you call them? The gramophone
turntables.
Turntables. Yeah, I think there's been an increase, isn't it, in sales because
yes, I saw they were selling it was something silly like one a second at HMV, I think, at Christmas. So I think I think it's something that is coming back. I think it will probably stay a niche market, but still, sort of an important music market nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. Well done you, and wish you all the luck. And I just wanted to talk about, I discovered last night that you were in the film Candlestick. I haven't actually seen it, but it's a thriller, isn't it? It's sort of capturing the Hitchcock vibe. And that came out last, no, 2014, was it?
Well, it was sort of officially released last year. It's an indie British film. And as you said, it is a Hitchcock-style thriller. But it was... it was fantastic to do, and we had a little premiere out in Hollywood last year, so I got to go out there and put on the black tie and do all that kind of thing, which was very exciting, very nice. And yes, it's available online and DVD, so if you search for Candlestick Film, you'll be able to find it there. I play a very geeky sort of estate agency type person who's... wife appears to be having an affair with my best friend, and it all goes quite dark.
Right. Well, good for you.
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, quite. But it sounds really good. And thank you very much, Nigel. It's been lovely, lovely talking to you. And I wish you all the best for Travelling Man that comes out.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, really, really enjoyed. And wish you all the best, as I said. And thank you very much. And enjoy your time in Somerset, and have a lovely time playing in Cambridge this weekend. Thank you, Nigel.
Yeah, very much looking forward to it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
My guest in the studio with me just now is Delia Naylor. Good afternoon.
Hello. Hi, Mike.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
A little while since we saw you. I think it must be, was it before Christmas? I can't remember if it was before or after now.
Just after, I think. Yes, okay. We're talking about strokes last time.
Ah, that's right. Yes we were, yes, indeed. That's right. Yeah. Actually, you made a second appearance because I had to fill in for one of my colleagues, and we used that that interview once again. So double chance to a very important subject anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Yes.
So Delia, for those of you who haven't heard Delia on Cambridge 105 before, is an occupational therapist, and in that respect, you help people that are recovering from situations. Because if anybody's like me, although I'd heard the term, I really didn't know what an occupational therapist did.
Yeah, well, really, occupational therapists assist or enable any person who's recovering from an illness or an injury or due to the aging process. So our role is really to assist them to become independent again. So, you know, they may have to restart their function and tasks, daily living tasks, and how they do things again, you know, if they're after a stroke, etc. So that's really, in a nutshell, what OTs do. They enable people to reach their full potential.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so today we're going to talk about home bathing.
Yes.
And I don't mean swimming.
Could get the swimming costume out.
Yeah, indeed. But it's obviously something that, I don't know, I guess it's not just older people that it affects, because if you have had some sort of trauma at a younger point in your life, then you may well need help. So okay. I guess, what could we start by just saying, what kind of people
require help with home bathing?
Well, anybody really. I mean, as I said, anybody who's recovering from a major illness, anybody who's got a long-term difficulty. It could be somebody with a short-term difficulty, but an OT is likely to get involved if the person has had a long-term illness. So it's not maybe an ongoing illness, maybe like Parkinson's, or they've had a stroke, or they're recovering from major surgery. But you know, anybody like that, or they've had an injury, so they've had a road traffic accident and they've been left with a permanent disability as a result of the accident, or they've got osteoarthritis in their hips, etc., or people who are aging as well. So
okay.
Really,
so it's anybody with mobility issues, essentially.
Mobility issues, really. So I mean, you know, everybody has to wash, you know. So it's an issue that affects, you know, people from all walks of life. It's not just, you know, this type of client group or that type of group.
So what kind of help is required? Because I guess we're talking about people actually going in the bath, are we? Or would it be people who shower as well?
Well, I mean, an occupational therapist could be referred somebody by a GP or a charity, or the person themselves, or their family member or carer. They may be referred via maybe social services. They might contact social services and they'd be put through to the occupational therapy department, and they may say, oh, my mother is having a real struggle getting into the bath. So it might be that they're able to get into the bath. They might be able to get their legs over the bath, but it's the actual up and down mechanism. They're finding it a real struggle. It's quite, you know, baths are often very slippery. They can be quite dangerous places in a way. You know, certainly for people who are maybe a bit more frail. So it may be that the occupational therapist would be the right person to advise and provide information.
So is that the role of the occupational therapist in this instance?
Yes.
That it's more of an advisory role in terms of changing your home environment to be more,
yes,
sort of acceptable?
That's right. So so they would be looking at the person. If they say, oh, I've got a bathing difficulty, so they may be going out to that person and looking at how they get in and out of the bath at the moment. So they would want to know what they actually do. You know, if they sit on the side of the bath, or they say, oh, I can't lift my legs. They'd have to see exactly what they can do in and out of the bath.
So it's partially an assessment of their mobility issues.
It is.
And then giving recommendations.
Yes, it would be an assessment of their mobility and transfer. So how stable they are, how safe they are, etc. So if, for instance, they're coming via the social services, they've been referred to the social services, they've been put on their waiting list, and then the OT comes out. The OT for social services would be working under certain criteria. So the criteria is cost-linked, obviously. So they'd be looking at whether they could issue a piece of bathing equipment for them, whether they'd be safe to manage that piece of equipment, either in the short term, while they're looking at a longer-term solution, or whether actually a short-term solution like a bit of bath kit is not actually going to meet their need. So always, the OT is always looking at the longer term need. So a person, an older person, may say, actually, I don't want my bath removed, I don't want anything, you know, I don't want to have a shower or anything like that. So they'd be trying to work with them to see if it was safe for them to manage in and out of the bath with maybe what you call a bath lift, which is a piece of kit.
It's like a hoist, is it?
Yep, so yep. It sits inside the bath, and at the press of a button, it moves the person up and down in the bath. But they're quite cumbersome bits of kit, and if there are other people in the house, they may have to remove the bath lift every time they want to have a bath. And also, they're not terribly... They're comfortable to sit in, but you can't recline very easily, and some people want to get right down into the bottom of the bath.
Is the aim, by using various bits of equipment in the bathroom, to try and give independence to the person? Because obviously, you know, having to help get somebody to help you bathe is, for most people, going to be an embarrassing situation.
Exactly. It's very difficult. So yes, so the aim is to actually maximise the person's independence as much, but also to work with them, because obviously if you're maybe of older age, say, you know, I don't know, 85 upwards, you've also got to work the person in realistic terms, in terms of, you know, are they going to carry on living in their own home, if they are living in their own home? Or they might be living with their daughter. So what's the setup? Where are they actually living? Is, for instance, for the longer term, it may be practical to suggest that the bath is removed and a level access shower is put in. So it would be safer for them. But a lot of older people may find that very difficult. They don't like baths. Sorry, they don't like showers often.
It's a newfangled thing, I guess.
Newfangled thing. Yeah. Also, the funding for it is quite a big modification. So, you know, there's the funding issue as well. So how do they fund it? A lot of older people, I'm not saying all older people, but, you know, quite a lot of cohort of older people wouldn't want the upheaval. Mm. They would prefer to strip wash than actually have their bath removed.
Right.
So every situation is different.
Can you mentioned about funding and so on? Can people who are in this situation, is there any means to have grants or any other sort of funding?
Definitely, depending on the route that you're coming via. So if you've gone on the social services waiting list, then for bathing equipment, then that would be funded by your local authority. So Cambridge City...
Automatically, or would you have to apply?
If you've had an assessment by an OT and they've recommended a bath lift and the person is in agreement, yes, I'm happy to have the bath lift, then that would be funded by Cambridgeshire or Cambridge City, etc., provided the OT has recommended it. And that would be, they would put in a prescription to their equipment store and the equipment store would deliver it to the person's home.
And otherwise, if it wasn't being funded by an authority and so on, what kind of price are these kind of things? Are they very expensive?
Bath lifts cost anything from about £300 to £500.
Right.
But there are other means. Like
plus installation costs as well, I would imagine.
Not for a bath lift.
Okay,
a disability retail company would come out and fit it in your bath, and that would be part of the cost of the bath. They wouldn't charge you extra for that because it's a removable piece of kit. But there are charities out there, like the British Legion. British Legion will fund things like bath lifts if they've had an OT involved who would recommend that piece of kit.
In situations where, for some reason, the local authority won't fund it?
Well, yes. So sometimes people don't want to go on the waiting list because it might be a long waiting list.
Okay.
Or it might be they've been a veteran. Or they don't meet, for whatever reason, they don't meet the local authority's criteria. So it might be the OT might signpost them to, well, you could go to the British Legion if they've been a veteran. They have to be a veteran, first of all. They can't just go to the British Legion. Or SAFA. If you've got veterans, then they can go to SAFA. They could go to the RAF Benevolent Fund, British Legion. I think there's the Armed Forces Fund. There's all sorts of different ones for veterans.
And it could well be that when you use the term veterans, in my head, it makes me think of older people, but of course these days with the amount of wars that we are engaged in, it could be a younger person.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's also, you know, all sorts of people from all walks of life. Or it could be one of their children. You know, it doesn't have to be the actual veteran itself. It could be somebody in their family. So they, the British Legion are pretty, you know, they're pretty welcoming. So if somebody comes to them, it may be that they would meet the social service criteria, but they haven't thought to actually refer themselves. Mm.
So what kind of equipment are we talking? Because you've mentioned about hoists for baths,
yes,
and so on. I know my in-laws,
yes,
they had a rail on the wall in the bathroom just to give them stability,
yeah,
I guess.
Because
you said yourself that you can slip, can't you, very easily.
That's right. So there's all sorts of bits of
What about baths themselves? Sometimes you see baths with kind of a door on.
There's the special integral baths. They're quite expensive and they're not funded via... local authority wouldn't necessarily fund them unless there's a very good reason. They wouldn't, because they would often argue that the bath should be taken out and a shower put in because that's better for the longer term.
And if it was a shower that was put in, can you get something like a seat to sit on, for example?
You can, yes. I mean, if you're taking the bath out and putting in a level access shower, then the OT would recommend the shower, the seat, the shower unit itself and the doors, etc. They'd recommend everything to go with the shower. And funding for that could be via a disabled facilities grant, which would be issued by the grant department at the council. But obviously you have to be means tested for that. And sometimes for some people their income is too high, so their contribution would be quite large. So, you know, they may not be eligible in a sense. But there were lots of other bits of kit. There's bath lifts. There's things what they call like bath boards and seats, which is just a piece of, you know, it goes across the top of your bath, and then there's a seat that you lower down. They're very basic bits of equipment. And then there's other types of equipment, like what they call swivel bathers, which sit on top of the bath again, and they've got a seat with them. And they're good if you've got an over-bath shower and you need a bit more support. So if you have balance issues, maybe a swivel bather might be quite a good idea. But they do just sit on the top of the bath. You can't go down into the bath with
all them. These things that you're describing, I guess, in my head again, makes me think that you need a degree of dexterity to be able to manipulate the equipment to get it in the right position, or get yourself in the right position to make use of it and so on. And there will be some people, I guess, whose mobility, is so limited that they don't have that level of dexterity to do that. So yeah. In situations like that, what do people do then?
Well, the best solution is to buy from a reputable company. So there are disability retailers around our region. You know, there's companies like, I think there's Cambridge Mobility, there's B Mobile in Seymour Street. There's other mobility retailers. I don't know all their names. But if you go into one of those shops, they're very helpful.
But if you can't use equipment yourself, that's what I'm saying, is if you actually, your mobility is so limited that can't manipulate the equipment.
Yes. Well, you could have it fitted into your bus.
Can you get people to, can you get people, if you can't use equipment, what are the alternatives to using equipment? Can you get somebody to come and help you bathe and so forth?
You can. I mean, if you, for instance, if you decide you don't want to go down the route of a level access shower, you just want to keep your bath, and you can, with help, get your legs over the bath, then obviously you could be eligible for a care package. You may have to pay for that, depending on your level of income. That would be assessed by the local authority. Home care team or care agency may come out, care manager may come out and see you and assess your need as part of a bigger package. It's all about safety, really. Enabling you to stay at home. So for that, you may have a carer that comes in, say, once or twice a week and helps you bathe. But the actual equipment itself, that would need to be properly fitted.
Right.
So the idea is, I mean, obviously these days a lot of people buy stuff off the internet. What I'm suggesting is actually much safer to actually go to a proper disability retailer who have got the training and the knowledge to be able to guide you in the right type of equipment. Also, they can come out and they can fit it for you.
So is the internet a bit of a blessing and a curse in this instance?
Well, it can be,
yes. Because it's a bit like home medical diagnosis, isn't it? Everybody Googles whatever their condition is and finds,
that
they're full of problems. And I guess it's true of that you know that you can't do it, so you probably go on to Google and find something
exactly.
that does it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the difficulty is that just buying something off the internet, it may not fit your bath. Mm. Maybe you might not be able to actually understand exactly how to fit it properly, or you might not get the right type of equipment. And that's why it's really important to have an OT involved. So whether you're doing it privately or you're doing it through a charity or via the local authority, it's really important to get an OT to come out and do an assessment first, and then they can advise you as the best way forward. So if they say, well, actually, I think you would manage with some bath equipment, they can then signpost you to the correct people. So if it's through local authority, that they can put in an order to the equipment store, and then they can come out and it'll all be for free. But if you don't want to wait on the waiting list, you say no, I'm going to go out and buy my own, you may have to pay for their assessment, but they will give you the right advice, and they may signpost you to a disability retailer. If you do go on the internet, there are disability retail companies like Nottingham Rehab. They're very good, and they have an advice line. You can phone them up. You could order the equipment through them, but they will give you instructions of how to fit it and that sort of thing. So they have OTs that work for their company. The other very good source of information is the Disabled Living Foundation, and you can Google them, and they have all sorts of information, and they will have retailers in your area which you can contact. So those sorts of things, I think, if you're going to be buying your own equipment, it's certainly worth contacting organisations organisations like the Disabled Living Foundation to get the right piece of information before you sort of start. Because I have seen so many, in my time as an OT, I've seen so many people who've bought things and then they actually don't use them because they can't fit them in their bath, they're not suitable, or they've had a level access shower done privately, but it's in not in a good, you know, the layout of their bathroom is a bit strange and it's been shoved in a corner and they say, well, I can't get in and out of it, it's too narrow, you know, etc. So I think really the starting point is to actually get an OT out.
Absolutely. It sounds like it is, because clearly it's a situation where you need to have good advice, yes, to make sure that the decisions that are made are the right ones. Really.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Delia, time's up, I'm afraid. Okay. It's wonderful to have you back with us again. Next month, what are we going to be talking about next month?
Well, I thought next month we'd have a complete change and we'll talk about mental health.
Oh, right. Goodness me.
There's been a lot in the news about mental health recently, and OTs are very valuable. They have a very valuable role in working with people who have mental health,
Brilliant.
Mental illness.
Brilliant. All right. I look forward to that. Thanks very much for coming in. All right. There we go. That's Delia Naylor. Delia is an occupational therapist and will be back with me again next month.
Guest Ellie Stoneley is in front of me. Good morning, Ellie.
Good morning.
You're here to talk about your book, Milky Moments. I've been describing it all morning as a pioneering book, which is quite a label to put on it, but it is really, isn't it?
Apparently, yeah, when my daughter was born, she was given lots of books and for her christening, but every single one of them that had anything to do with infant feeding, so just in the context of the book, had pictures of bottles. And she was bottle fed, she was nose tube fed, and she was breastfed. So it wasn't that I'm some obsessive, mad, crazy breastfeeding person, but it was just, it just struck me that there was nothing to do with breastfeeding, and there were all the posters in hospital saying breast is best. And I just thought, well, that's odd. And then at her christening, all the cards, bottles, little teddy bears, little dummies. Again, nothing to do with breastfeeding. So it just kind of dwelt in my head as an idea. And I thought, well, there must be a gap in the market. And again, is that because nobody wants it? Or is it because nobody thought of it? And several agents said, oh, nobody wants it. And I don't know, something in my head just thought, no, I really want to do this. And it became a bit of a compulsion. And yeah, so now it is the only book really on the market that shows people breastfeeding as part of daily life. So not so much because a new sibling's coming or because they want to wean a younger child or an older child. But it's just saying this is normal. Wherever you do it, this is perfectly normal.
And I think the sales have showed that there is a gap in the market. Let's just describe it for people who haven't seen it. It's a beautiful book. It's a picture book. What age group is it aimed at?
It seems to have fallen into the sort of 2 till 7 or 8, particularly. I've had emails from parents who've said that their older children who used to breastfeed really, really enjoy looking through it.
Yes, I can imagine it does sort of trigger that nostalgic feel, even if you're...
Yeah, and also from parents as well, and from grandparents. I've had a lot of emails from people who said, I bought it for a child or for a present, but just decided to keep it because I used to breastfeed and it stirred some sort of elemental thing inside me. So again, it's just amazing that it's touched people in that way.
And it's really, it's a series of snapshots or situations in which children are being breastfed.
Yeah, I mean, it follows 6 families through daily life. So there's a scene at a playgroup, which is actually based on my experience at the wonderful playgroup that we go to on Mill Road. There's a picture in the park, there are pictures on the beach, visiting a granny, just, you know, day-to-day pictures. The breastfeeding isn't the centre point of the picture in all of them. In some of them it is, in others it's just a group of people having a cup of tea or just a scene of children playing, but somebody is breastfeeding in every single photo. And the children being breastfed are newborn babies, so there's a little child that was sick in hospital, which is based on mine and my daughter's experience. And then there's a much older child who's about 3, again, based on a picture of my daughter and I. So I wanted to say that it's not just newborn children that are breastfed, but actually children who are much older are still being breastfed. And that's far more kind of omnipresent than people would imagine if they read the tabloid news.
And there's no reason to be delicate about breastfeeding at all. It is the most natural thing in the world. Did you have to think about it when you were briefing the illustrator as to how much you show and why that's a problem? Because it's become political, breastfeeding now. I mean, who would have thought, as I say, it's the most natural thing in the world. It's what our bodies were designed for.
Yeah, it was interesting. The book came out around the same time that the idiotic politician, who I won't name, talked about women breastfeeding under a napkin in the corner. And
there's no napkins in this book.
I've breastfed, not sort of publicly and dramatically, you know, completely topless, but I've breastfed pretty much all over Cambridge. I've never ever once had anybody say anything negative. I was in a mobile phone shop and somebody actually offered me a cup of tea and a chair. So it's always been a very positive response. I think it's entirely down to personal choice. Some people, particularly when a child's past 6 months, they tend to fight off covers. So if you do put a cover, you may end up inadvertently exposing your entire breast and nipples and everything because the child is fighting off the cover. So actually it's far more comfortable probably for you and for the child if you just, you know, lift up a shirt or pull down a top if it's hot sunny day. And the child's head covers everything. And so really,
no woman
it's
wants
very rare
to be.
That somebody does walk into a cafe and actually pull down their entire bra and sit completely
well, who would
topless?
Want to do that? You know, no so. Woman wants to do that, really. But you want to feed your child safely
absolutely,
and comfortably.
And just, yeah, I mean, and it's also, I mean, the kind of analogy that people make all the time is that, you know, Lady Gaga or whoever is, you know, accepting an award covered in slices of meat with her nipples showing, or, you know, celebrities are constantly photographed wearing, you know, dresses slashed to the waist with nipples poking through, and that's perfectly acceptable. But as soon as he posted, until recently, a breastfeeding photo on Facebook, it was taken down as considered inappropriate.
But so it's
kind of double standard that
yeah.
Page three and breasts have been sexualized rather than being celebrated for what they're meant to do.
So in this book, it's just honest pictures of women breastfeeding. They're lovely pictures. And the illustrator, she's a local artist.
Yeah, they're hand-painted illustrations by a lovely girl called Jessica Dalton Good, who I met because she was selling cards of chickens and elephants at Burwash in the shop there. And just lovely illustrations. And I actually asked her if she'd do a picture of my daughter and I. And we worked on the book together. It just became a real labour of love. There are constant themes throughout the books. There's a little teddy bear to be found on every single page, which is called Eric, named after my daughter's teddy, which is kind of a Where's Wally thing. So on every single page there's an Eric. There are also little chickens and little sort of different things in a border around the cover, again, taken from all the illustrations in the book. The words are all written as little rhymes. So again, it's a very lyrical read to read to children at bedtime. So just talking about, you know, what they've done in the day, or the fact that they've fallen over or hurt their knee, or the fact that they've had to run to catch the bus. So just very much sort of daily scenes, ends with a bedtime scene, so perfect for kind of calming down at bedtime.
And I was just looking at the quotes on the back. There's a quote from Jacques Girard, director for England Royal College of Midwives. They've been very supportive, haven't they?
They've been
and
amazing.
She says, is it she?
Yes.
She says, a delightful picture book that normalises breastfeeding for young children. And is that what you want your readers, your young readers, to take away?
Very much so, because it just struck me that if people generally, and not, I think Cambridge is quite unusual because people do breastfeed a lot in public in Cambridge, but elsewhere in the country it isn't quite so sort of consistent, and elsewhere in the world, in the States particularly, it isn't so sort of public. And I just thought, well, if children are to grow up and we want breastfeeding to be normal, there are massive health benefits in terms of cutting down cancer risks for the parents, huge benefits for the children. They need to grow up seeing it. It needs to grow up normal. Otherwise, they're going to grow up in a world where breastfeeding isn't on the television, it isn't in the press, and it's not in any of their literature. So when they come to be mothers or fathers, it's not going to be something that they've been aware of because they've only been exposed to bottles. And so I just wanted it to sort of be part of normalising it, not just for society generally, but for children as they grow up.
And what has the reaction been on the whole? I know you've had some amazing reactions.
It's been incredible, and this always makes me feel a bit tearful, but it's just been very, very, very moving. I find it quite embarrassing talking about it because it's just so humbling that people could respond to something that I've done in such a positive way. And I never dreamt, A, that anybody would publish it, and the first publisher I approached did. But also, when the first reviews started coming in, I just sat there completely flabbergasted that people sort of got it and understood it. And then when emails from fathers saying, there's one particular picture of a child that was ill in hospital and just saying that mama's milk has made you strong. And this lovely chap called Simon, who I don't know, wrote the most amazing review on the publisher's site, just saying this should be on every single family bookcase. And it's something that fathers need to be aware of to support the mother. And the only negative comment I've had was on Amazon, and it was a 4-star review, not a 5-star review. And the lady had bought the copy of the book for a friend who was a single mother. And she just said, I can't give it to my friend because there are too many nice dads in here. And there are also single mothers, So I wanted it to kind of cover everybody, but it's also good for dads to look through thinking, well, you know, that dad's cooking dinner, this dad's carrying a bag, this one's bringing a glass of water. So it's saying that the dad can be part of the breastfeeding experience by supporting the mother and by playing with other children, or just by, you know, sitting next to the mum and just having a chat with her while she's doing it.
That's not a bad negative reaction, a four-star review, is
it? Everything else has been incredible.
And like every writer, you always hook on to the negative, but you've had amazing positive responses because people have responded to this book in a very emotional way, haven't they?
They have. It's reminded people who used to breastfeed of the sort of intimacy and the bonding moments that it does provide, the sort of moments of silence that it provides. You know, when you have a child and you're rushing around and you're busy, you do have this magical milky moment when you are just sitting, finally the child's latched on, you just exhale and you just have this kind of moment of peace. And I tried to kind of capture that in the book. And then hectic times when you're rushing around, you don't have to faff around sterilizing bottles, you can just nurse your child, whether it's on the bus, you know, you have a moment there. So I really wanted to capture that, and people have just responded phenomenally, and children have loved looking at it. It has helped. There's a girl at playgroup who I'm quite in awe of. She's a very grown-up journalist, and I was always a bit uncomfy. Is that the right word? Yeah, it probably is. Showing her the book, because I thought she'd think it was a bit trivial. And she actually phoned me through the internet the other day, and she's just had a baby. And she said, your book has been a godsend because it prepared my older child for the fact that I would be giving birth in hospital. And it also prepared the older child, who's three and still breastfeeding from time to time, about the fact that his younger brother would be breastfed. And now she said it's the only book this little boy's wanted to read. And that's been amazing. And I've also had an email from somebody in Texas saying that their little boy was offered the choice of birthday party. You know, generally boys would go for dinosaurs or for Thomas the Tank Engine. And her three-year-old wanted a Milky Moments birthday party.
Wow.
So, yeah, well, that's, it's just been amazing. Incredible.
That's amazing for you that something you've written has reached across the world that way. I mean, considering you were thinking there wasn't possibly a need for it, I think that's shown there a need. But the sales as well, didn't it sell uber quickly?
It sold out in the first 3 weeks, the hardback copy. And then, so the publication of the paperback was brought forward 3 months. That's been selling well.
And now you're up for the People's Book Award.
I know, which is just amazing, for the Children's Book of the Year.
So, and that's based on public vote. And you're saying people can't start voting, unfortunately, until May.
Well, they did vote in their masses for the autumn round of voting. And there were, I think, 8 books. And Milky Moments came top. And it was the most voted for and the most complimented book for the autumn round of voting. So that put it through to the final. So it'll be up against 11 other children's books. And there's a massive public vote. So I'll be marching up and down the streets of Cambridge with a big banner saying, please vote for us.
Oh, you do that, and you get in touch with us here, and we'll mobilise
May,
our
June
audience.
And July, and then there's a very swanky presentation, kind of Oscars-styly award ceremony at the end of July.
So, oh, wonderful. Yeah. Your head must be slightly spinning, Ellie, because, you know, this was something you thought about, and then it's materialised into this beautiful book, and now you're going to an award ceremony and you've got a best-selling book on your hands. How does it feel?
It does feel just humbling, and I can't quite believe it's my book when I look at it. It is so beautiful. The publishers, Pinter and Martin, did the most wonderful job with it. Jessica's pictures are magical. And just the whole thing, it's a combination of sort of lots of love. And I just feel very humble about it, and also very grateful to people who reviewed it. All the mums at playgroup, when I was researching, you know, I read them poems to see if their children liked it. I showed them pictures. The Cambridge Breastfeeding Alliance, who are remarkable women, they looked at every single picture to say, no, the nipple's in the wrong place, or the baby's head's too high, or the hands are holding the baby wrong. And I wanted to make sure that it was able to be used as a teaching aid. So the La Leche League of Cambridge as well, both of them had input to make sure that the holds were right and the positions. And they've been tremendously supportive. And because of the book, at the book launch, somebody that was there found out about the La Leche League and the Cambridge Breastfeeding Alliance needing more funding, and they were able to raise more funding as a direct result of this particular person who'd been helped in hospital by somebody from the Cambridge Breastfeeding Alliance. So that helped save them at a point where they were about to go under because of lack of funding. So that, to me, has been the amazing thing, that something I've done has been able to enable other people.
Amazing. Amazing that a book can have that impact on so many people. Congratulations. It is a beautiful book. As you say, it's published by Pintert & Martin. It's £11.99 in the hardback, but well worth it. The pictures are lovely. The words are lovely. What's next for you then?
I'd like to do another two in the moment series, which will also be sort of attachment parenting. So around just kind of, you know, children interacting with their parents, children interacting with nature, getting a bit muddy, getting a bit sticky, doing baking at home and all that kind of thing. I've also been asked to write a book about my own journey. I had IVF when I was 47. My daughter was born when I was, very nearly 48. And that was quite a journey. I was told I'd never have children, and I now have a remarkable little girl who's now 4 and incredible. And just generally, I don't know, different things strike me.
Does she read this book?
She's very proud of this book. We've just come back from Ireland. We went to a breastfeeding conference in Ireland, which, again, you know, that's really odd. I never dreamt. I was a very corporate person. I never imagined I would suddenly be at a breastfeeding conference. But it was the most fun I've had for months. And Hope was marching around saying, "Do you want to buy my mummy's book? This is my book." And she goes through the pictures, and a lot of them are based on photos of Hope and I, saying, "This one's me, this one's my mummy, this is my teddy." And she was a great sales rep. And she even offered, when she saw me doing book signing, she said, "Do you want me to sign it too?"
Oh, bless her heart. And it's dedicated to many people, and she's one of the ones it's dedicated to. Yeah. It's lovely, Ellie. Thank you very much for coming to talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Good luck with the People's Book Award. Good luck with continuing sales. I don't think you need any luck with that. I think it's just going to keep
flying. It's on sale
flying
across the internet, on Amazon and all of these.
And it's called Milky Moments. It's by Ellie Stoney, as they published by Pinter & Martin. Thank you again, Ellie.
Now I've got my very, I'm really looking forward to it. I've got J.S. Watts here today. She is poet. To celebrate the launch of J.S.'s new poetry collection, Years Ago You Coloured Me, which was released at the beginning of this month, there are going to be a variety of events and occurrences taking place across March. Good morning, J.S.
Good morning to you.
Oh, it's really nice to have you here.
It's really nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Is this the first time you've been on Cambridge 105?
No.
Oh, good. So good. That means you're even more relaxed when you're here.
That's indeed. Funny.
So tell us about this is your third poetry book, but actually your fifth book, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, I'm one of these weird writers that don't just write one type of thing. So I write short stories, I write novels, so I've got two of those out, and I write poetry. So yes, it's my third poetry book. It's a full collection, and I suppose if you can have a theme to what is about 50-odd poems, it's recollection, resonance, echoes and memories, things that have left an influence on possibly me, certainly the world. So that's kind of the theme that's looking out. A lot of poems about memories, a lot of poems about colours, funnily enough, because I've always found art to be a major influence. There are quite a lot of art-themed poems in there as well.
Well, because the title, you've got Colourful Launch, is that right? Is that the part of the launch slogan, or is that something that you dreamed of? Or
Something I dreamed of, yeah. I'm afraid. But it seemed appropriate because, I mean, at a very basic level, the book is called, as you said, Years Ago You Coloured Me. So, Colourful Launch, it's launching a book with colour in its title. But as I said, the poems are multi-layered. There's a lot of poems about art, so a lot of colour in it. So, again, colour seemed appropriate. And what I've tried to do with the launch this time, I've tried to avoid the big bang theory. Often you do with book launches, you go, yay, book launch, end of story, ba-dump, that's it.
Yeah.
So, hence, I said, it's been a month-long launch. It came out, crept out at the beginning of the month, but is ending hopefully with the big bang at the end. So lots of different events, radio, videos, things going on. So that was kind of colourful, I thought. And certainly with the two launch readings at the end, they're not a standard, it's not just me standing up. The first one on Easter Sunday, I'm at Allographic, which is a regular poetry night in Cambridge, meets on the last Sunday. And that has open mic, has lots of different voices, lots of different colours in it. I'm the guest artist this month. And then on Tuesday the 29th, if I've got my dates right, it's the Tuesday after.
It is, actually. I've got it here, 29th.
Oh, good. I'd like to know my calendars. Again, I suppose, the official big launch. But again, I'm not doing it on my own. I'm doing it as a joint fundraiser for the inaugural Cambridge Literary Fringe Festival, in other words, which should be taking place in June. And that itself is another grouped item. The Literary Fringe is going hand in glove with an Arts Fringe Festival, so we come back to the multicoloured aspect of it. So a colourful launch kind of seemed appropriate with all that going on.
Oh, Jess, it sounds really interesting. And I've got to ask you this. I've been dying to ask you this because I did an English literature degree very maturely at Anglia Ruskin University. And, of course, I came across poetry. Gosh, I had such a mental block when it came to poetry. I just did not want to put it up there. I didn't want to read it. And then I started to read it. I had to do it. It was a module. And I really loved it. And they always say that if you it's something that you're not very good at or you just avoid, you've got to have a go and try it. So poetry, one of the questions I asked about poetry, one of my was why does poetry rhyme? Or doesn't have to rhyme now, does it? But what got you into poetry and how comes... Have you always loved poetry?
Yes, is a really strange answer. I mean, I can remember writing poems when I was junior school. In fact, I think one came second in the local London Borough competition. Oh, wow. So I think, I was writing at seven. But my mother, as mothers tend to be rather embarrassing, reckon she's got my first ever poem written at the age of four still stashed in the dining room drawer, and she threatens to drag it out whenever I get kind of too big for my boots. So given that I trust my mother, I think I must have started writing poetry really early. And I go back to, and I blame my mother again, she had as a child a collection of fairy stories for children, kind of Lamb's Tales of Shakespeare, Grimm's Tales, and they had poems in, and I inherited the book, so I can remember as a very small child just about managing to read Meg Merrilies by Keats. So there's always poems in there, so poems just kind of seemed natural to me.
They do, and when you listen, it's like listening to music. When you listen to somebody read a poem, or actually even I love it when people recite poem. I know I'm not putting you on the spot here, but do you have pieces that you can recite, or is that something that I won't do today? I'm going to put you on the spot, aren't I?
Oh, you are. I can grapple in the box and actually produce the book and read the front poem from that, or I could do one from heart which isn't in the book.
Go on then, right. Do whatever you want.
Okay, this is an amusing one. Normally done in the summer because it's about the joy of flesh, really. This started out taught as some notes upon skin, but my skin's too thin and lets other things in. It's a form of osmosis, new words just soak in, so the poem I finish won't be the one I begin. The hide on this poem is like a balloon that expands and expands till it rivals the moon. That fat angel face who's long lost her chin, so tell me, how many angels can fit on a pin? But each month she diets and grows painfully thin. Her guts fade away, the outside leaks in, until she becomes size O again. I'd like my own dermis to shrink to a grin, to laugh off the chips, the red wine, and the gin. But this leather's too old to flex like a fin. Too much weight lost, and this bag starts to sag, till it hangs on my scaffold like a weather-worn rag. So, I'll just flaunt this old pelt like a well-practised sin and just learn to love the skin that I'm in.
Oh, Jess, that's fantastic. You see, that's wonderful. I love it. I absolutely love it when people recite poem. It's just a fantastic. And even when they recite, like you do, recite lines from poems, it's almost quite a really therapeutic thing to do, isn't it? It sort of brings you back down to, I don't know, to where you'd like to be or where you would like, you know, you would like to be. I don't know. Is that something that you find really attractive to poem, that you can just literally recite something and it
does. It's a form of meditation, depending on the poem you choose. Some poems aren't. But yes, it goes back to actually the theme of the new collection, which is the resonances, the echoes, and words, either consciously or unconsciously, have echoes and resonances. And a lot of them are collected in poems. So if a poem works, and they've all got different ways of working, you pick up those resonances, the echoes that the poet had put in, maybe didn't even know they were putting in, and you share them, and that kind of, yes, takes you to a place beyond the poem, I guess.
And do you have family that are also into poems, or are you the pioneer, the champion for poems in your family, or is it something that...
No, I guess I'm the pioneer. I was the first of my family to go to university. I was the first of my family to write. We're great readers. I would say all my family are great readers, but I'm the only one that's actually put pen to paper.
Fantastic. So, Jess, tell us a little bit about... I'm just reading here that your poetry and short stories, book reviews appear in a variety of publications in Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand and the States, including Acumen, Brittle Star, Envoy, Mixlexia and Orbis, and being broadcast on BBC and Independent Radio. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
So how long have you been a poet then?
Well, so we go back to when do you want to start dating it? According to my mother, from the age of four, which is years ago. In perhaps more professional terms, I guess, well, I've always written. I wrote through school. I guess I started writing for publication, and this is really going to date me, back in the 1980s. Indeed, that's why I published under my initials, not my full name, because I got sick and tired of some rather unreconstructed editors going, ooh, didn't know women wrote about things like that, and that's an unusual poem for a woman. So I started using my initials so they couldn't work out what gender I was. And then I started getting published, and it stuck, so hence I go by my initials these days. So back in the 80s, yes, I did a lot of poetry for literary magazines, and was doing quite well. And then, as often happens, the day job kind of got in the way. And I was working in education, and you climb the greasy pole, which is great. And I'm still writing, but trying to get published kind of takes time, and I really didn't have the time. So the poems carried on, but I stopped publishing. And it was always, one of these days, one of these days I'm going to see if I've got a book in me, one of these days. And then it dawned on me, I suppose about 10 years ago or so, that actually one of these days wasn't getting any nearer. And this sounds very grim, and I hasten to add it was no one really close to me, but I knew three or four people my age or a couple of years younger who dropped down dead from heart attack, strokes, strange conditions. And you think, OK, how many more years am I going to keep going? One of these days. So back at the end of 2008, the opportunity came up to... leave the day job for a while, and I thought, right, I'm going to have a gap year. I never had a gap year as a youngster, didn't do it back in the day. I'm going to have a gap year, I'm going to take a year out, see if I can get a book out, see if I can earn a living either writing or writing and doing other things, and then I'll go back to the day job in a year's time. And that was 2008, and it's now 2016, and 5 years later, I'm still writing.
Jess, that's fantastic. And it's just tell us a bit more what's happening next. So you've got your launch on the 29th. That's the main one, isn't it? Is that right, on the
29th? That's the big one, yes.
The big one.
The big one.
And let's just repeat that again. That's going to be at the Cambridge Arts Salon Gallery.
I think that it goes by various names. It's also called Thrift's Art Gallery.
It's on Thrift's Walk, isn't it? Yeah. So
whatever name it goes by, it's there. It's the new art salon gallery area thing in Thrift's Walk.
It's a great name, actually. It's a real old Parisian, isn't it? Salon.
Yeah, absolutely.
That reminds me of Gertrude Stein. So this is joint fundraiser for the Cambridge Literature Fringe Festival, in other words, it's called.
That's right, yes. Led by Faye Roberts, who runs Allographic, which I mentioned earlier. A group of us have been thinking for a while it'd be really great to have a literary fringe festival. We've got the big fringe festival, which is wonderful and attracts lots of big names to Cambridge, which is really fine. But what about the other voices, the ones that don't get heard so much, whether because on the fringe of the community or because I haven't had an opportunity? So we're fundraising to kickstart a new literary fringe festival in June, provisionally across the 17th to 19th of June. Kind of the social media stuff will be happening shortly. Hoping to launch a Bard of Cambridge and lots of kind of literary spoken word, not just kind of written word poetry, but performance poetry, lots of spoken word events. And I'm told by Faye, so blame me if it's wrong, that if you can't wait for the social networking and website stuff to go up, if you want to email her at fringe@allographic.co.uk, she'll let you know all about it.
Thank you, Jaya. So it was so lovely talking to you. I feel honoured to be talking to a poet. I really do. So I just want to go back. There is no entrance fee for all these evenings, but donations will be sought and appreciated.
Indeed, particularly for the fundraiser, because we are raising funds.
Jaya, thank you so much indeed. Jaya Swartz, the poet who brings out her book, Years Ago You Coloured Me, and that'll be out, it is out in March. And of course, you've got the event happening on the 29th of March at the Cambridge Arts Salon Gallery, or Thrift's
Gallery. It seems to have lots of different names these days.
Brilliant. I'm going to bring up the travel now, but thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.